Hello and welcome to the Contemplations of the Lotus Eaters. I'm here with Josh, and
Hello.
Today we'll be talking about Buddhism. This is Contemplations episode number 20, and Josh is going to tell us all about the history of Buddhism and its founder, his life, and everything around it.
And as well as his teachings as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, Buddhism, as you probably might expect, was kind of developed in the Indian subcontinent by someone referred to in modernity, although not at the time, as the Buddha, simply meaning the awakened one. So many early texts refer to his name being Siddhartha Gautama, which is what I'm going to go with now, just for the sake of simplicity. But because it's so old, we don't really know for certain. Many details of his life are relatively inconsistent as well. But it's one of those things that's quite difficult to establish what's what, because everything is so old. And it's similar to Taoism from yesterday, in that we kind of have some ideas, but it's not entirely clear.
So is it actually clear that he existed, or he was a single person? Like, for example, in Taoism or even Jesus, right? You don't know if that was a single person or there were multiple people.
I think we don't really have too much reason to doubt it. Mm-hmm. But it's possible that it's like anecdote after the fact, you know. There's no verification in something that goes so far back.
And how far back does it go?
It's sometime in BC. I didn't actually look up what era it was, but it's a couple of thousand years BC at mm-hmm. the very least. I should have really looked that up, shouldn't I? But never mind. It's not important to the actual teachings themselves and the history, but I believe it's kind of the same sort of era as kind of Taoism.
Right.
Although I think,
which was more or less 4000 BC.
Yeah, I think Buddhism might be a little bit further along, mm-hmm. maybe 2000 BC, that kind of time, because, for example, in China, Buddhism came after Taoism. So,
right.
Although it did come from the Indian subcontinent, Buddhism, Taoism obviously was developed within China.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of indicates that there's some degree of a difference between the two. But it's very difficult to actually place a specific time because it goes so far back.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say, you know, 3,500 years ago. Some say maybe 4,000. Some say 2,000. It's difficult.
Okay.
Because
so there is no like specific calendar that would start at that date or something like that. That is
no,
as
not,
is tradition.
As far as I'm aware,
okay,
there isn't. But that doesn't mean it's not the case. There's so much that has kind of been added on to Buddhism over time that I've focused on a very narrow portion of it, because Buddhism has been integrated into things like Hinduism, which wasn't naturally a part of it when it was first kind of formulated. But there's lots of additional things that have been added on. Like in Hinduism, they see Siddhartha Gautama as some kind of deity, whereas in the time that he was probably walking around, they didn't see him. They just saw him as a spiritual teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that there's been lots of kind of distortions of the original content after the fact, and there's been lots of additional things added on. And there's probably potential for that even with the oldest documents we have as well. So some of the texts claim that he grew up in somewhere called Kapalavistu, which is near the modern border between Nepal and India. However, he spent most of his time in the northern Indian provinces of Bihar, which you can see here, and Uttar Pradesh. I think that's about right. I don't speak any languages other than English, so I'm going to butcher everything I pronounce today.
Adds value to it, that's good.
So, some claims about his life and teachings and society he lived in, like I said earlier, may be some kind of invention later on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people may have had a vested interest in kind of creating a cult of personality around this this person that may or may not have existed. Just because if you are a practitioner, you want to make out that the founder of your kind of practices is as great as possible, and
mm-hmm.
that makes you look better. And although that's not a very Buddhist thing to do, it's a very human thing to do, and it doesn't make sense to not prescribe those same things on people just because they might scorn on it. in other circumstances.
And it's better if you espouse a certain set of ideas, it's better to ascribe that to a specific person. It makes it more human, makes it more palatable, rather than have it in the abstract that is more difficult for a lot of people to kind of imagine and grasp.
Yeah, and I think
it's better to have a teacher.
In having just a person being the one that kind of came to these realizations, it makes it seem more attainable as well.
Yeah, so if he can do it, you can do it as well, because he was a human too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He wasn't ordained by like a higher power, just like it was given to him this wisdom, some other religions, which I will not name. Some people seem to claim that he was descended from royalty, but others seem to suggest he was descended from just a rich family. And again, it's one of those things that's difficult to tell. But I think if he was busy wandering around thinking about all of these things, chances are he probably had the wealth and resources not to worry about food. He's traipsing around in rags, sitting under trees, thinking about stuff. He's probably doing all right for himself, if that's his priority. He's not starving.
But then we'll come to the point where part of the teaching is to beg and to live off food that's been given to you. So
he's like the proto Marx, isn't he? Where he comes from a life of wealth and then starts begging off of and getting money off of other people. Now,
is that a merch idea on a t-shirt? Would I say proto Marx?
To be respectful to them, there's no actual evidence that he actually practiced the begging side of things himself. Yeah. It was more a thing that was developed further on.
Okay.
But anyway, some early texts such as the, this is quite a long word, I'm probably going to mess up, the Pali Ariya Pariyasana Sutta. I think that was about right. Ariya Pariyasana Sutta. There we go. Which translates to the Discourse on the Noble Quest, and the Madhyama Agama suggests that he was moved by some suffering and the kind of cycle of life and death that he saw in his life. He hadn't experienced it himself, but he saw other people suffering, and this kind of troubled him, and this motivated him to find some means of freeing people from suffering. And this is what kind of set him on his path, according to these books, towards trying to reach a point of nirvana, or just freedom from suffering, as we would know it in English, I suppose. So I think it's worthwhile talking about the two teachers that are mentioned in these texts, which are actually mentioned by name, which is quite interesting considering... It's such a long time ago, you'd think this kind of thing would be lost. So the first one is Alara Kalama, who was more or less a hermit who kind of lived in his own retreat and was something known as a Samrana philosopher. And Samrana simply is one who labours, toils, or exerts himself for some kind of higher religious purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of that aesthetic sort of thing where they're minimalist in possessions and they sit there doing nothing with little food.
So how does that tie into the suffering, the alleviation of suffering part? Because that was the point according to the previous text. And here you have a person who's a saint or who's a teacher in that, you know, framework, because he labors, toils, and exerts themselves for a religious purpose. So how does that kind of toiling and kind of suffering, presumably, how does that reconcile with the goal of the alleviation of suffering?
I think Buddhism views suffering as something that is somewhat inevitable, but it focuses on how you can kind of almost liberate your mind from the psychological and physical consequences of suffering. So you can be put through things that would otherwise make you suffer if you were less enlightened, but it wouldn't faze you because you've followed this correct path.
So it's stoicism again.
It is, yeah. It's another form of stoicism, really. Just another form, but I think Buddhism adds a lot more spirituality to it when compared with Taoism and Stoicism.
Yeah, and to be fair, Buddhism was probably most likely earlier than Stoicism. So
that is true. Yeah. So Alara Kalama has been described as someone who was kind of a spiritual seeker who lived in a life of austerity and an aesthetic, as I said earlier. Mm-hmm. And the Saramanic, I'm struggling to pronounce these things. These traditions are supposedly quite diverse, and we know roughly what some of the practices are, but some of them are conflicting, so it's difficult to know which kind of sect this specific teacher came from. Mm-hmm. Some either accept or deny the concept of a soul, for example. Some are fatalists, some are not, in that human acts occur by necessity and hence are unfree. So it's some saw things as kind of deterministic and some did not, which is quite impressive considering most early kind of belief systems believed in free will, and they arrived at the correct conclusion earlier on, but that's a whole other podcast.
I mean, there's this different point of view is based on kind of different basis, of course. It's not based on neurology, right?
No.
So it's based on observing you in nature and in the things that you can't really do anything about, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's forces of nature that you can't really overcome. So you might say that, yes, like nature is pressing on me. It forces me to do these things and I can't do much about it because I'm weak compared to nature. And so I don't have any free will. There's nothing I can do about it. And I'm kind of forced to go through this life in the way that nature prescribes.
Yeah, and because it was such a long time ago, they were probably living much closer to a state of nature than we would now. So it makes more sense to kind of have these ideas proliferate.
Mm-hmm.
So some practice severe asceticism in that they are very self-disciplined and avoid all forms of indulgence. However, some didn't really mind. So it's one of those things where belonging to this philosophical practice didn't really necessitate much in the way of a strict orthodoxy. There was a lot of freedom for people to think for themselves and come up with their own kind of path, to use that term once again. So some of these practitioners also believed in total nudity in everyday life and believed that clothes only made you further from the correct path.
Wearing clothes is degeneracy.
there's still, funnily enough, like if you go to like an Indian religious festival, mm-hmm. as you do, of course, there are still people who just walk around completely naked, and that like blows my mind that there's just people fully clothed, you know, with their phones, like modern technology, and then there's just this guy with nothing but perhaps a turban on, just walking around, stark, naked. Just like, yep, no problem here.
He's the true based person. Yeah. Most grounded in the ideas.
It seems a little bit weird to me, to be honest. Well, I mean, there's also the fact that if you actually believed that, like the only way mm-hmm. to be kind of follow the Buddhist path is to be naked all the time. That's not going to really work out if you live in like Scandinavia.
Yeah, but if you live in India, they might.
Yeah, it's funny. It's almost like it's just a belief that kind of suited the place it was developed. Almost like it's just made up and a load of rubbish.
Maybe not. Maybe it was developed there and they got add some kind of truth there because they had favorable circumstances, and in less favorable circumstances, you wouldn't be able to discover the truth because you would have to wear fur all the time.
Or maybe they're just cheapskates and they don't want to buy any clothes, I don't know. But so some of the other teachings of this kind of philosophy promoted strict non-violence and vegetarianism, whereas others also were accepting of violence and also meat eating. Mm-hmm. So again, diametrically opposed beliefs here.
And so violence in what sense? As in, if something... So non-violence would mean that even if violence is done to you, you should kind of maintain a pacifist stance, not really defend yourself, because mm-hmm. that's counterproductive or something like that.
I think it depends on the individual in question, because there's such a diverse array of things. There mm-hmm. were some teachers that believed in absolute non-violence, even if you're attacked, you shouldn't fight back, whereas some saw like war as perfectly fine, like going out wars of conquest and mm-hmm. you know, taking resources because you can is fine, which I think is a little bit questionable for its philosophical and moral guidance, but there we go. It was a few thousand years ago.
You should walk around naked because clothes are too degenerate, and let's go to war.
Imagine that, just loads of naked Indian priests running at you. That'd be scary. But anyway.
Maybe it's a good strategy for battle.
That's what some of the Celts did, right?
Did they?
Yeah. Didn't you know that?
No.
Yeah, they used to fight stark naked, unless that's a misconception. It sounds like one of those things that people just make up. But
it's like the Viking horns.
Yeah, that's a good example of it. So eventually Siddhartha Gautama's teaching with Kalama ended, and supposedly Kalama said, "You are the same as I am now. There is no difference between us. Stay here, take my place, and teach my students with me." However, he didn't want to do that, and he left.
Yeah.
Which is...
It's anticlimactic.
I know. But he went on to be taught by someone else. But I would like to take an aside and talk about meditation for a minute, because mm-hmm. there's a practice of meditation that kind of is all the way back to prehistory almost. We don't even know when it started, but it seems to be particularly in the Indian and kind of East Asian areas very common.
And so it's tied within the ideologies and the traditions, spiritual yeah. traditions that have developed, including Buddhism.
Yeah, and so it's not exclusive it. To it, but I think it's something that people associate with it very mm-hmm. strongly. And I know that Buddhism now, a lot of the teachings promote meditation as a way of exploring your ideas and your mind to kind of get to this point of nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Taoism that we spoke about yesterday is also one that may look at Buddhism as another means. You may remember us reading out some of the passages from the Tao Te Ching, and I think those were things that people were meant to read, memorize, and then meditate upon,
mm-hmm.
as far as I'm aware. At least that's what it seems like to me would be the purpose of it, in that it was in short, memorable passages, kind of poetic language, and I think it's designed to be thought about. But nevertheless, there is also evidence that meditation can be found in Jewish traditions as well. I know that some of the old Jewish books, I can't remember the name specifically, mention about people meditating as well. So it's something that is home to the East, I would say, from a European perspective anyway. Mm. And it's been around for thousands of years, and we don't really know. There's some kind of expertise-related changes in attentional and brain structures that have been found in neuroscientific studies, which is something that I'd quite like to talk about, if you would humour the distraction.
Okay. So not about spiritual side of things or mm-hmm. of meditation, but about what it does to your brain and to your
personality. Yeah, and there's significant evidence to suggest that mm-hmm. it really does what it sets out to, in that you can look at a neuro image of, say, regular person and a Buddhist monk, say, that's meditating, and you would be able to tell the difference if you knew what you were looking out for
mm-hmm.
between the activity in each of the brains, or lack thereof, in certain areas. And I'd like to get on to something in particular, which is focused attention meditation,
mm-hmm.
which kind of does what it says on the tin, in that they focus their attention while they're meditating. Never would have guessed. But so the first study I'd like to look at is attention regulation and monitoring in meditation. And they say both Western scientists and Buddhist scholars recognize the ability to focus and sustain attention on an intended object, which requires skill involved in monitoring the focus of attention and detecting distractions, disengaging attention from the source of distraction, and redirecting and engaging attention to the intended object. These capacities have been associated with dissociable systems in the brain.
Okay.
So what they're saying there is that meditation is something that is a skill that allows you to alter your focus, more or less. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So there are neural systems involved in focused attention meditation, and in particular in conflict monitoring, where you know your attention is conflicting, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex are involved. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is the one that's kind of here and the front of your head. The anterior cingulate cortex is a little bit further back. Just to give a kind of concrete definition of conflict monitoring, it's something that contributes to cognitive control by detecting conflicts in information processing and signaling when increased top-down control is required.
Mm.
So it's about having some kind of executive control over your own mind. And also in terms of selective attention, the areas that they've identified are the temporal parietal junction, ventral lateral prefrontal cortex, which is again front of the kind of where your forehead is, and the frontal eye fields and the interparietal sulcus. I'm sure that doesn't mean very much to people, but it's important to kind of highlight that these various attentional areas in the brain, it's not just you have this kind of one area and it controls attention. It's spread out in lots of disparate areas and it has neural pathways that connect to a broad range of places around mm-hmm. your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And the final one is sustaining attention, which is kind of largely focused in the right frontal and parietal areas of the thalamus.
So do they use, if they have people who are meditating and who are not, and mm-hmm. they do their brain scans or monitor their brain activity, do they use that meditation to search for areas of the brain that do certain things, such as focus? Or
so the attentional stuff has been, it's been kind of established without any connection to meditation mm-hmm. per se. The study of attention is quite old and the neuroscientific research into it is quite extensive, so we the kind of field of studying meditation is a lot smaller than the attentional field. Therefore, the wealth of information that you get from attention, just as a discipline in isolation, is enough to talk about these areas and say definitively these are the ones that are involved.
Right.
And we know from additional studies that have found that there are differences in these areas in people who meditate.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the research is focused on the attentional side, just kind of in isolation of the meditation. But there are studies of the meditation that found that there is an effect on these areas that have already been established, if that mm-hmm. makes sense.
Yeah. And so these people who meditate are able to activate these areas better or more intensely.
Have greater control. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be good to move on to this next study, because this really demonstrates that point quite mm-hmm. well.
Right.
So this is called Meditation Alters Perceptual Rivalry even in Tibetan Buddhist Monks. And they say here, with the support of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, a total of 76 Tibetan Buddhist monks varying in experience from 5 to 54 years of training, including 3 retreatist meditators, each with at least 20 years experience in isolated mountain retreats, were tested using non-intrusive perceptual measures at or near their mountain retreats in the Himalaya, Zanskar or Ladakhi ranges of India.
Right, and so they were measuring perceptual rivalry. And what is that?
So it's better to use the term binocular rivalry, because mm-hmm. that will probably make a bit more sense. So you know how you have two eyes? That's not really surprising. Each one, you know, casts an image. And because you have two eyes feeding you with two images, your brain has to put them both together and make a coherent image. Mm-hmm. And this is something that people don't really think about, because it happens naturally.
Yep.
But because you have this binocular rivalry, or two eyes casting one image in your mind, mm-hmm. You can have situations where there's an inability to reconcile, and that's what causes optical illusions.
Right, right.
So when you see an image and it keeps on switching between different things, as you can see on screen here, so you can see here that if you look at it long enough, it looks like either a duck or a rabbit.
Is that because each of your eyes sees a different thing? So if you look at it only with one eye, you will see one thing and the other, because
you can only focus. So if you have like one eye open and you kind of look at one part, you can only really focus on one part of it. Whereas if you have both, you're kind of seeing.
Right. So the illusion is based on, like, when you're looking at one specific spot, you will interpret that as one specific animal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you see multiple spots at once, you mm-hmm. will have different information about the animal, right? So if you look at the right part of this, I would imagine that it would be more like a rabbit. And if you look at the leftmost part of it, it would be a duck. And so if you look at it with two eyes, well, that seems like both. Like that's why mm-hmm. that's why that happens, right?
Yeah. Yep. And that's the binocular rivalry mm-hmm. aspect. If you mm-hmm. have one eye closed and you look at it like that, then it is not really going to happen, because you've only got one eye open. There's no rivalry.
Right, right.
So they didn't necessarily use this. They used something with some green lines, but it wasn't as interesting to look at, so I didn't bother including that. But you can look at the actual resources they used in the link to the study in the reading list below, or at least on the website. I know we've had people ask us about the reading list on YouTube, and we always have it on our website, just to clarify.
Yeah, so just go to lotusheaters.com, and there you have everything. All our episodes and all the reading lists and everything.
Exactly. And so they, in this study, they actually had the people who had concentrated on something known as one-point meditation, which is a form of focused attention meditation, and another form of meditation as a control known as compassion meditation.
Okay. And so what were they focusing on? Whether, like, what the object was, the rivalry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what were they trying to find? What would be different in those monks?
So what they did was they put an Oculus Rift, you know, mm-hmm. like a virtual reality headset on them with an image, and they got them to report how often, with either a button or verbally, their perception would switch between seeing one thing or another,
mm-hmm.
and kind of your average person would, in say a minute, see, I don't know, 30, 40 different mm-hmm. switches, where it stays constant for maybe a second or two before it switches. And I've done this before, and it actually switched more than average for me. I don't know what that says about me, that I've got a really bad attention span.
And so with the monks, it would be very few switches.
Yeah, that's the kind of rationale behind it. So they found that 50% of the monks reported extreme increases in perceptual dominance during or after one-point meditation. So they looked at both, if you do the meditation before you looked at the illusions, and also during, if you're meditating during and you're looking at this thing, whether mm-hmm. it affects it, and it didn't really make a difference whether it's before or during. It's relatively the same. However, they found no change for the compassion meditation. So it seems like the focusing attention meditation, or the one-point meditation, as they call it here, mm-hmm. seemed to actually have the intended effect, in that they were able to concentrate far better than the...
Right. And so was there a difference between So you said that the one-point meditation, that kind of thing, was effective in this particular measure.
Yeah.
But was it something that they did and then they measured their responses after they meditated? Was that different from just people who've had a lot of experience meditating their whole lives?
As in, themselves?
Crucial? Yeah, what was crucial? Was it crucial that you have a long history of meditating, you're trained in this, or that you've meditated just like 5 minutes ago and now you're doing the test?
Well, I think it's largely down to experiences, because two of the retreatist monks that had been living in isolation in the mountains reported complete perceptual stability. So they reported no switching whatsoever throughout an entire 5 minutes, which is quite phenomenal, really, because even in a minute, the average is kind of 30, 40 times. Mm-hmm. So that's really impressive. And I think we can take them at face value, because they did add in kind of measures just in case the monks were suggesting that they were better than they really were. But the fact that the compassion meditation found no change whatsoever, mm-hmm. I think also helped, because it was the same monks doing the different forms of meditation.
Right.
So right. They knew both, and the compassion meditation didn't seem to do anything, whereas the 1 point meditation did.
So it was just looking at how immediate meditation, what the effect of that is, not of having that brain that is trained in meditation that has been trained over a couple of years.
Well, because it was against that, the control was them doing a different form of meditation.
Right. So there was no control with people who don't meditate at all.
Yeah. Well, there have been other studies that have looked at this, and they've found that lay people that meditate seem to be able to control their attention better mm-hmm. than otherwise. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting to see the extent of these so-called experts. And how much you can really achieve, and the fact that, you know, these retreatists managed to maintain a singular kind of perceptual stability throughout the entire 5 minutes, even though when I'm looking at the duck or the rabbit, it switches very quickly for me.
I mean, it switches when I just look around the picture, but when I just look at one part of the picture, it doesn't switch.
Not at all. You're some kind of meditation expert then, secretly.
I don't meditate almost at all. But when I just look at one part of the picture, it doesn't change. But as soon as I start looking around, then it does change.
It might be a bad example because we're looking at it from quite far away. It's kind of got to be kind of cover your vision and be your only focus mm-hmm. because it's a little bit far away, you can kind of get away with seeing the whole thing with one eye.
Yeah, so it like it emerges, right? Because why that kind of duplication happens, or why that misalignment happens, is because when things are close, you see it from a different perspective, because mm-hmm. the eyes have a space between them, right?
Yeah.
And so if things are further away, then that difference becomes negligible.
That's a good point, yeah. Very true. So the closer things are, I suppose. And if they had an Oculus Rift,
it would be right in front of their eyes,
which is probably part of the reason that they used that and not something else, because it's close to the point where they're not just holding something right in front of their eyes and being obnoxious about it, but it's going to maximise that effect.
Oh, I'd be interested to try it. Try the actual thing, not just like that, mm-hmm. which doesn't seem to work that well.
I've seen optical illusions with the Oculus Rift, and it made me feel so sick. It was unbelievable. Like, I don't get seasick. I don't feel sick from like flying or anything like that. But as soon as I was seeing these optical illusions, it was weird. I felt like I'd been drugged or something. Like, I took the thing off, and everything was moving around, and it was bizarre. I've never experienced anything like it. I don't recommend it. Actually, it's kind of horrible. I felt really disorientated. So anyway, this tangent aside, I'm going to go back to the life of Siddhartha Gautama mm-hmm. again. But as you can see, there is some degree of validity to meditation. Mm-hmm. which very much surprised me, actually. So I just thought it was a load of rubbish, really, until I actually studied it. I actually had to write an essay about it while I was at university, looking at the cognitive and neuroscientific evidence, and it kind of converted me. Like, I was like, okay, fair enough, that there actually does seem to be something to it. So I was a skeptic beforehand, but...
So now you walk around naked?
Yeah, all the time. This is actually an illusion. I'm not actually wearing any clothes. But anyway, the second teacher is someone known as Udaka Ramaputta.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also kind of a meditator and a philosopher. And he focused on the sphere of neither perception or non-perception.
What does that mean?
So I think that's attention regulation again. In the,
okay.
If you manage your attention to the point where you're not focused on anything, then that is kind of this state, isn't it? Neither perception nor non-perception.
Right. So what you mentioned before, the ability to switch between not focusing on anything and focusing just on one specific thing that you want to focus on, mm-hmm. and just keep switching between the two, precisely how you want.
Yes.
Okay.
The teacher himself found things... It was Siddhartha Gautama who found this guy's teachings relatively unsatisfactory. He didn't really find much use in being able to control your attention, apparently, which is a shame because that's the only thing we actually have talked about that has evidence. But he turned to a strict life of asceticism involving both fasting and controlling his breathing. Mm. So the breathing control doesn't mean just being constantly aware that you're breathing, which I'm sorry for reminding everyone of. It's a bit of a horrible thing to do.
Now you're breathing consciously.
I am, yeah. It's synchronizing your breathing with your movements. So it's not necessarily trying to breathe consciously, because it's kind of a waste of time. Automatic is obviously the most desirable thing. But there was a view that if you breathe as you move in a certain way, that it's more desirable than otherwise. I don't really think there's much to that necessarily. Maybe, I mean, I haven't really looked at the science of it, so maybe someone's going to prove me wrong in the comments. But
so what do they claim it does? What it does for you? As in, what do you get out of it?
It's supposed to be just more fulfilling, I guess. Brings you closer to a state of nirvana.
Oh, okay.
But it seems hard to believe, really.
So it's like, controlled breathing, right? And conscious mm-hmm. breathing techniques, what they do is they mess around with the oxygen that goes into your brain, right? And so then you kind of experience things, you get kind of drugged on oxygen or lack of oxygen or kind of different dosage that you can regulate by that breathing. And so that's kind of the point behind some of these techniques, right? And whether this is something like that, right?
So you're saying that he could have just been really delirious when he came up with all of his revelations later on. He's just controlling his breathing. He's just starved of oxygen. And then he takes a big breath. He's just like, whoa.
Yeah, something like that. Unironically, you know, if you're poor and you don't have money for other drugs.
His state of nirvana was just head rush.
I don't know. This is just my kind of hypothesis of what you could get out of it, out of things like that.
I've not really entertained the possibility, but that certainly seems feasible.
And the combination of like meditation and these breathing exercises of like sounds like it can be something interesting. I mean, I'm not an expert. Like, this is what I'm just generating mm-hmm. my thoughts right now. But I'm sure there's people who've tried things like that and got hurt.
Well, it's not like you can really hurt yourself by controlling your breathing that much. I don't really know. I'm no clinician by any means.
Yeah. I guess, yeah. let's just move on. I don't think we can dig deeper into this too much.
Sure. So anyway, after he started living this aesthetic and kind of fasting and breathing lifestyle, mm-hmm. He began meditating under a fig tree, trying to withdraw his mind from automatic responses and sensory information, and leading to a state of perfect calmness and awareness. That's kind of the almost like the Taoist state from yesterday, in that you're kind of one with things.
Is this a bit different because you're trying to avoid any sensory input, right? You're trying to just be inside your own head. And the Taoism thing felt more like you're trying to adapt to outside life and you make your peace with it.
Yes, it is.
And not withdraw from it. There's a different mechanic, I think.
Yeah, and I'm far more understanding of the Taoist perspective than I am the Buddhist one. But then
I am ignoring reality.
Yeah, I don't really see the utility in doing this. Maybe I'm just unenlightened and I'm not spending enough time meditating because I don't do any. But
this might sound bad, but is it something that might have something to do with narcissism? When what you want to do is just spend all your time in your own head, because you like the contents of your head so much that you don't want to engage with the outside world at all.
I mean, that's a very uncharitable interpretation. But
I'm just asking about it. I'm not saying that's what it is.
Okay, I don't know, because they're not exactly ego driven, are they? In their rags, sitting under trees, kind of half starving. I mean, that's not the behavior.
It's a different kind of egoism. You feel very virtuous if you do that.
There's no virtue in being half-starved. And
enough for you, but for them.
Yeah, I suppose. But
there's a hierarchy of being the best monk.
I'm sure that probably does play a small part in it, but I would imagine that they would be aware of that sort of thing and they'd be kind of like, no, this is bad. This is against the ways or the path to enlightenment. But nevertheless, Siddhartha Gautama reportedly felt awakened and he gained insight into the workings of karma and his former lives, which, of course...
He got really drugged on oxygen.
It might be the case, because former lives, I mean, what's going on there? You're sitting there and all of a sudden you gain insight about reincarnation, which I definitely don't believe in.
So he was like sitting under the tree, like starving, getting high on oxygen. He was like, I remember being a duck in my previous life.
I'm not sure whether, I don't know whether this early form of I don't know what the word is because I want to call it Buddhism, but this kind of, I think it's Sam Rannick philosophy that looks at karma in reincarnation. I don't know whether it actually says that you could be other animals. I think it focuses on humans, but I'm not entirely sure. It could also be animals as well.
Maybe I'm mistaken with something else, but I thought there was a hierarchy of what you can be, and you can be a human if you've been good in your previous life as something of less sort of value, like an animal or something like that.
I'm not sure if that's a later addition. That's where my reservation is coming from.
Right.
Because I don't know whether a lot of the kind of wording of some of the older texts seems to imply that you can only be reincarnated as a human, but that might be a translation thing, or it might just be that I misunderstand it. So I don't necessarily want to mislead anyone.
Oh, it's definitely possible that I'm mistaking it with something else.
I know what you're about, though, because I've heard that before as well. So supposedly, Siddhartha Gautama brought an end to his cravings for existence and an end to his appreciation of sensual pleasure and an end to his ignorance and suffering, which is quite bold claim, really, isn't it?
And to his ignorance and suffering, right? Yeah. Well, so he managed to withdraw from the real world into his own head enough so that he
reached this
wasn't
state
able
of nirvana.
So he wasn't able to suffer anything anymore because nothing would have an effect on him.
Yeah, and this supposedly broke the cycle of birth and rebirth, which is taught in the samsara tradition.
And so, what does that mean, break the cycle of birth and rebirth?
So they believed that if you don't reach this point of nirvana, you are constantly born and reborn into suffering. So you are born and you die, and in that time it's suffering. It's basically the Jordan Peterson perspective of life is just suffering, which I don't really agree with. It's a very pessimistic view of life. It doesn't have to be suffering. It's a very dim view that you have to withdraw from everything just because there's a chance you may suffer.
And so the point then, the ultimate goal, is to reach mm-hmm. nirvana. And when you do that, you don't reincarnate anymore, so you don't need to suffer any more lives.
Yes, is that the point of it, I believe, yeah. And his kind of revelations led to him becoming a spiritual teacher, and he advocated for something known as the middle way, which balances extreme indulgence with extreme asceticism. So he kind of got rid of the extreme aesthetic side, where, you know, your fasting, it seemed to him to be unnecessary, which, you know, fair enough. Don't eat too much or don't eat too little. That's not exactly bad advice, is it?
You should not eat anything, but you should not eat bread.
No, eat as much bread as you can. That's my moral guidance for today, if you take away anything. But
this is the central point of Buddhism, eat bread. It's probably not, I don't know.
So anyway, back on to his life. Until his death at the age of 80, he continued to teach what he had learnt, and he gained a following who eventually wrote down his teachings and their own interpretations of his teachings and sought to teach other people, which is how Buddhism spread.
Okay.
So I'd like to move on to just some of the things that they had wrote down about his teachings and some of their interpretations. It's not entirely clear which are his and what are their interpretations, because there's no real clear delineation. But I'd like to move on to the kind of some of the more fundamental stuff, because there's so much out there that I'd be here for hours talking about it. But what I'm going to talk about is the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So to start with the Four Noble Truths, the first one is dukkha or something like that, which is more or less translates to suffering, incapable of satisfying or painful, which is an innate characteristic of existence. I think we touched on this beforehand. And then there is another truth, which is samudaya, which is translates to origin or arising, which is kind of talking about cravings, desires, or attachment kind of arising naturally from this innate characteristic of suffering, which makes sense. If you're suffering, you have desires to not suffer anymore.
Right. So just the compulsion to do better, or kind of get out of suffering, or improve your lot, or something like that.
Yeah. Not necessarily focusing on that in general, but just the nature of suffering creates a desire for things.
Okay.
And then the third noble truth is that of nirodha, or cessation or ending, as it translates, which can be attained through letting go. And that's about detaching oneself from the sensory experiences of the world, as Siddhartha Gautama did in his meditation, I assume.
So that's overcoming those desires by withdrawing from the sensory experience, sensory life.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of a parallel with Taoism here in that it focuses on letting go and ending your desires. And that's something that is very consistent between the two belief systems, in that it sees desire and cravings and worldly things in a negative light rather than a positive.
Yeah. It sees it something natural to humans, but something that you need to overcome. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And then the fourth one is MAGA, which isn't Make America Great Again, by the way. It is the path, or the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is just the path you need to follow. You need to follow the path of MAGA. It says here in Buddhism, that I'm not sure whether that makes Donald Trump a reincarnated prophet of Buddha, but
a Noble Eightfold Path in connection to MAGA, right? That sounds like some cryptic, some key shit.
No, it's not some kind of conspiracy theory, but we do have the Eightfold Path, which is outlined in this fourth noble truth. So it kind of phrases it as what these virtues are that you need to follow this path. So the and first
so,
one.
Wait, oh. So why are those four noble truths? Why, like, what's that? What's noble about them? Like, why are they called that?
I think they're just the four most important principles. It's almost like the truths or the noble truths. It's just like the four most important principles. You need to think of it in that kind of sense.
Okay. So like the basic principles of the universe that is the most important thing to know about how the world works.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the Eightfold Path is as follows. There is the first of the eight is the right view, that our actions have consequences. Death is not the end, and our actions and beliefs have consequences after death. And this is what is explicitly mentioned in things like karma and rebirth. Obviously, I am an atheist, so I do not believe that there's life after death or reincarnation. So I don't really think there's...
Hey, you don't need to be a theist to believe in reincarnation.
Well, it's a spiritual thing, though, isn't it?
It is, but it's not necessarily a religious thing.
It's also, reincarnation doesn't make sense from a neuroscientific perspective.
No, I'm not arguing that it's true. I'm just saying it doesn't have to be religious.
Of course, yeah. Okay, I will concede it. Fine.
Being too skeptical. Don't you want other lives? If life is not suffering, you should want to live more.
The person that you are comes from the biology of your brain, and once you're dead, it's not like all of these thoughts that make up your personality and who you are just magically drift off. They are just the summation of the electrical impulses created by your brain, and once that brain stops working, that's it. That's all there is. There's no, like, where are these electrical impulses going to go if they're not being created by the brain? But
I don't know. Maybe there's some backup, you know, being stored somewhere. As you think things, you know, it's being uploaded somewhere else.
There's some kind of like,
doesn't it can be either technological, you know, we're living in a simulation, or it can be something that you don't know about. Something like I know, like the DMT people talk about, like different realms that coexist with our kind of the world that we can see. There's things that exist parallelly.
Mm-hmm.
Parallelly to that, but that you can't see without like being on drugs and doing shit.
Doesn't sound too appealing, really. you're not even going to be yourself then if you're in this new realm.
No. My point was that if there's things, other kind of realms or dimensions or whatever, something like that you can't see because you don't have the tech, you don't have the capacities to kind of observe it properly. That could be ways in which what you are, what your thoughts are, what the biology is, gets projected somewhere and then just goes on in like somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible, but it's also possible that there are invisible creatures that we can't possibly detect all around us. I mean,
like rabbit ducks.
There are secret rabbit ducks all around us that mess with our optical.
Just to make clear, I don't believe any of this is true or anything like that. I'm just like throwing things out there that it could be theoretical true. I don't know. Like, I have no idea. I can't tell.
playing devil's advocate is always a good thing. So don't worry.
And I do think we're living in a simulation. So,
all right, Elon Musk. So, the second of the Eightfold Path is the right to resolve or intention, the giving up of your home and adopting the life of a religious beggar, more or less, in order to follow the path. The concept aims at a peaceful renunciation into an environment of non-sensuality and no ill will, and a movement to love and kindness rather than cruelty, and a movement towards compassion. And supposedly such a lifestyle aids the contemplation of the impermanence of life, of suffering, and the non-self.
Yep. So what you're saying is that Swindling crusties are in the beginning of the right path to nirvana.
Yes, having no home, if you're homeless, you're closer to Buddhism than if you have a nice home and you're living a wholesome life, providing for your family. It seems a little bit silly to me, I'm not going to lie. The third principle is right speech, which is no lying, no rude speech, no telling one person what another says about him to cause discord or harm in their relationship. I mean, that's fair enough.
You're not supposed to lie to them, but you're not supposed to tell them something inconvenient.
It's kind of weird in that if you have been told something that might upset someone else, you're not to tell them, even if that is a kind of passive dishonesty.
Yep.
So it's a weird sort of right speech. But I understand the rationale for it.
No, sure, I can understand that it's a rule of thumb. Like, you can't always follow those 100%, but it's something to kind of keep in mind.
Someone's like, yeah, I'm going to go over and punch that person in the face. It's probably up to you to say, okay, well, this person's going to do this to you. You might want to watch out. And that would be a good exception to the rule.
But yep.
I'm just being a pedant now for no real reason. So another one is right conduct or action, which is no killing or injuring, no taking what is not given, no sexual acts, or no material desires.
So, no taking what is not given. So, that is not the branch that condones conquest and warfare.
Yes.
Okay.
I found it amusing that no sexual acts, so incels are also closer to a state of nirvana.
Need to be an incel, Krusty.
So from here, basically be homeless, be kind of not sexually active, be poor. It's just, it's the complete antithesis to what we see in Western society, really, isn't it? All of the values are the inverse.
Yep.
So Buddhism, officially subversive to the West,
and so
I declared it.
So that's why the value that you're supposed to strive towards is withdrawing from everyday life, withdrawing from outside life into your own kind of head and mental space,
mm-hmm.
right? To, and that includes all of it. That doesn't include just, okay, I'm not going to be rich, but that includes sexual activities. That includes kind of striving towards and like valuing what others might value, because you don't want those desires. You don't want to strive towards something that has no meaning, right?
Yeah, that's more or less what we were talking about earlier, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Don't really want to dwell on that too much because I think it is pretty self-explanatory there. Another one is the right livelihood. Beg to feed, only possessing what is essential to life or sustaining life.
Yeah.
That's again looking at the kind of life of a beggar. You kind of get the gist here.
Yep.
And then right effort, preventing the arising of unwholesome states and generating wholesome states, restraint of the sense faculties.
That's meditation, right?
It is, yeah. More or less controlling your mind. And right mindfulness, which is focusing on retention and being mindful of the dharmas or teaching of elements. And that are beneficial to the Buddhist path. So that's just keeping the Buddhist principles in mind, more or less. Can be interpreted as like never be absent-minded, being conscious of what one is doing, encourages kind of awareness of the impermanence of the body and what the mind is feeling and body is feeling.
Yeah, I think mindfulness has become quite popular over the last couple of years, so people probably know what it is. And this is the same thing, right?
There's actually an entire school of therapy known as mindfulness therapy, where it just teaches people how to introspect more effectively, which is kind of a little bit condescending, but I suppose some people could benefit from it. I'm certainly no expert.
It might be useful, right? I don't know. It's just my layman's point of view.
But it seems inherently elitist to me that it's just like, I know how to think about your mind better than you do yourself. But
even if you can't do it, you can kind of teach people how to teach them the practices.
I suppose you're right. I'm just, after reading all of this, I'm just skeptical of everything now.
Are there rabbit ducks? Aren't there rabbit ducks?
They could be. I mean, anything's possible according to this.
Everything's in flux. Nothing exists. Nothing is real. Santa doesn't exist.
No. Let's not be rude. Right. The The final principle is that of right samadhi, which is practicing meditation, which includes the different stages of meditation and reinforces developing kind of still mind and being mindful, which is very much what we touched on earlier.
Just repeating the previous points, I think.
Okay. So what is your kind of overall impression of the principles of Buddhism? What is the what can you kind of see as the main benefits and the main drawbacks from this kind of perspective?
Well, from the introduction that you kind of laid out here, I think meditation can be useful. Mm-hmm. And I've done some meditation and I found it useful, but I'm too lazy. I don't often find time for it, so I don't practice it regularly. But I do see that it's useful and that it has some like positive effects on me when I do it myself. So that's probably something that is good. But at the same time, the other things, I'm not really that kind of like very spiritual person in the sense that I would kind of elevate asceticism or things like that, or removing yourself from worldly pleasures. Like that's not what I think is very is a priority. You know,
it's not really good advice either, because I think that the smaller things in life, some of the things that make it worth living in the first place, like just it being a nice sunny day and you have something nice to drink, it's ultimately not very important, but it makes things enjoyable, but it's not really a vice.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that, but it still has some benefit. And in kind of rejecting these things, you reject all meaning in the first place.
Yeah, and I think, of course, you can say you should not be overly materialist. You know, you should not base your value or all your enjoyment, all your kind of life's purpose on like having nice stuff around you, you know, because that's kind of pointless. You need to find your kind of something meaningful, you know, something that you actually value, and not just something that gets valued by others and gets you into some kind of hierarchy that might be satisfying for a little bit, but not very much, you know. Fine, you know, I'm not saying this is not true and this is not useful to kind of keep in mind. I'm saying that this kind of striving towards removing yourself completely from that worldly life is something that I don't really see as valuable or good advice, as you said.
Yeah, and in some cases I might think it would be actively harmful to people as well. People are inherently sociable, and in removing yourself from the world and being in isolation in your own head is probably not going to do you any good.
And as with everything, I mean, there can be some people for whom this is something good, for whom this might be the best thing that they could ever find. I'm happy for them, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think that for most people, this is probably not something that they would enjoy or they would find the best kind of satisfaction in or happiness in life, right? And so for other people for whom this is not the best, like they have to come up with something different. But it doesn't mean this is not useful for some people. I can definitely imagine that this is great for someone.
Yeah, I think it's useful to know about, just in that some of the concepts that are discussed aren't always up for discussion in the West, and it looks at things from a very different perspective. And in kind of examining things that you wouldn't otherwise think about, it makes you look at it from a new perspective in a way that may be beneficial to you. So in talking about Buddhism, my kind of desire to kind of cover this in the first place was that it provides useful perspectives about things that may not necessarily be things that you adopt, but it makes you think about things that you may not otherwise, and in doing so you get some benefit from that. Mm-hmm. And that was my kind of justification for wanting to cover this in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, even if you don't necessarily end up following something or buying something completely, it's mm-hmm. valuable to know about it and to learn from it, to learn that you can view yourself, your own life and your own circumstances from a different perspective, mm-hmm. even if you don't necessarily adopt that perspective.
Yeah.
Like, that's always valuable.
And unlike Taoism, where I think that some of the principles are actually quite useful and I follow them in my own life, I wouldn't really follow much in the way of Buddhism, although there does seem to be some virtue in meditation, as you said, although I just don't have the patience for it. I just can't. I feel like I'm wasting my time, basically. It's if you're just sitting there doing nothing and thinking, it doesn't feel like you're using your time effectively at all. And if anything, it frustrates me that I'm not doing worldly things, because at least they have some observable effect on my life. Sitting there doing nothing, thinking about stuff.
That was a cruel ending.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Buddhism, but I'm not a fan. No, there are lots of interesting ideas that are discussed, and I'm sure that there are things that can really benefit people, and I hope that it's been interesting.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the introduction. And if you liked this video, make sure to check out lotusteachers.com, where we have all the other episodes of Contemplation so far, and where we're going to continue posting future episodes. And we've got loads of news and analysis content by us, by the rest of the team, and by guest writers. And so you can find that all free content and premium content at lotusteachers.com. And if you want to support us, become a premium member there. And we'll see you next time. Thank you for watching.
Goodbye.